He was almost obsessed by the idea of having to save these people.
On March 19, 1944, the storm hits, and the world of Karl Lutz and the Jews of Budapest changes forever.
Hitler thought he would need to control the country more closely. They said, the Jews are our enemies. As long as we have all these Jews in Hungary, they'll shoot into the backs of our German troops.
And it was Lutz, as the head of the Foreign Protection Division, had that came to handle the immigration of these Jews. Both the Germans and the Hungarian government were more interested in liquidating the Jews rather than permitting their immigration.
Schutz's protection. Every Jew wanted to have one, and they thought, yes, this paper will keep me from being deported and from being killed.
The Nazis are stunned. With one move, Lutz has violated Swiss neutrality, openly defied Hitler, and put his own life in jeopardy.
Mr. Lutz, very much to his credit, quite clearly exceeded his instructions by a huge amount, and that in itself is an act of courage.
By now, false Schutz briefs are circulating across the city. Lutz is ordered to come to the brickyard to sort out the real Schutz brief from the false.
For us, it was mental torture to have to sort out these documents.
January 15, 1945. In the night, the Red Army finally obliterates German defenses in Pest. Lutz is eager to see how many Schutz brief holders have survived, but the Russian occupation forces order him to be out of the city within 36 hours.
He was hoping at least that they would listen to what happened here. Everybody just wanted to forget as quickly about these things as possible.
Soon, indifference turns to accusation.
Du hast in Budapest deine Kompetenzen überschritten. Du hast zu viel gemacht für die Juden.
It's over 60,000 people. Today, for their children and their descendants, this must be a 250,000 or 300,000 people in the world that owe him their life. I mean, it's enormous.
You're listening to the Exploration Films podcast, where truth isn't an abstract. A deep dive into films from around the world. Conversations with producers, directors, and actors, where they discuss the behind-the-scenes stories of filmmaking and also reflect on their motivations and their worldview as storytellers.
Welcome to the Exploration Films podcast. I'm your producer and host, Steve Ryder. And today's film we're featuring is Karl Lutz, Dangerous Diplomacy. As a Swiss diplomat in Nazi-occupied Hungary, Karl Lutz could see what Hitler's regime was doing to Jews, and he just couldn't stand by. Most of you are familiar with Steven Spielberg's masterpiece, Schindler's List. Well, Karl Lutz ended up using his influence to save more than 50 times the number of Jews than Oskar Schindler. Being the history nerd that I am, this is one of my favorite films we're featuring this season. So I was super jazzed to interview director Brian Beruggi and Karl Lutz's stepdaughter, Agnes Hershey Grouse. Brian Beruggi, thanks for being on the Exploration Films podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So the film, I freaking loved it, because I've always been a big fan of World War II history. There's two periods in American history that I've always really been drawn to: Civil War and World War II. And World War II was in large part because I had two World War II vets, actually three World War II vets, that lived on my street growing up, two of which had a massive impact on my childhood and growing up. And so, you know, America's fight against, you know, the Nazi oppression and the Holocaust and what we were trying to liberate in Europe always just kind of really spoke to me as a kid. So I loved hearing this story about Karl Lutz and the impact that he had on this Jewish population there in Budapest. Talk about who Karl was and what drove him to make that kind of impact.
Yeah, Karl Lutz, he was born in Switzerland. He grew up in kind of a rural part of the country in a Christian family. They were Methodists. I think he was born in 1895. And yes. He loved being out in nature. And he had this spot where he would go up at an overlooked like this river valley. And he would think about going to the other parts of the world. He thought maybe I'd want to be a missionary. He just wanted to do something big in his life. Well, then fast forward to later on, he ended up emigrating to the U.S. and he went to school in the U.S. and worked for the Swiss government there. He was in Philadelphia. He was in Washington, D.C. He met his wife there. And then when he became a Swiss vice consul, they sent him to Palestine. And it was in Palestine where he started to see man's inhumanity to man, basically, and injustices and just a lot of stuff going on. And
what was it about that area? What were the injustices that were going on there in the late 30s, right?
Correct. First of all, he loved the whole idea of being in the Holy Land, partly because of his Christian upbringing, and he just wanted to see it. But it was also a unique time because he represented multiple countries, including Germany. And so that was back when Palestine was under British control, and it was just kind of a mess because you had the Arabs, you had the Jewish population, and it was just a tough time. I mean, he saw Jewish people getting beaten up and killed. He saw things like that. Mm-hmm. And he actually, interestingly enough, he represented Germany so well so that later on when he was actually going against Germany, at first they had a certain amount of respect towards him because of what he did for them in the past.
It was a very important period of his life, as he was a Christ and he was a Methodist, and his family went to the Methodist church every Sunday, and his mother was a Sunday school teacher even, so he was very religious. And for him, first of all, Palestine was the experience, as he was a very gifted photographer. He traveled all along and he visited these biblical sites and he made pictures which looked like 2,000 years ago with Bedouins. And we have a whole big collection of these pictures at Yad Vashem. We have so many pictures of that time that we could make an exhibition. Anyway, but it was important for him also for the contact with Jews, to know more about their mentality, to know more about the Palestinians. And it was very important for him that he took over the German interests when World War II broke out in 1939. And he had to take care of 2,000 German civilian people who were still in Palestine and who had to be repatriated. And he and his wife, Gertrude, his first wife, they did a very good job. And that helped him later in Budapest when he dealt with Eichmann about taking Jews under protection. And he had a very important experience in Haifa. He saw how a Jew was, I don't know how to say that in English, killed with stones, gesteinigt. Mm-hmm. Arabs threw stones and until the Jew was killed. And that impressed him very much.
Wow.
Of course, he told several times he spoke about this event.
In 1936, the Arab-Jewish conflict explodes into violence. From the window of their apartment, Karl and Gertrude are first-hand witnesses.
A Jewish worker was coming along around the corner, and he saw too late that he was faced with an angry Arab crowd. He was lynched. It made a tremendous impact on Karl Lutz and Gertrude Lutz. And he then he wrote back in a letter to his brother Walter that I really would like to help the Jews somehow, someday.
Why was he representing Germany as well as Switzerland? And what other countries did he represent? And why did they do that?
You mean when he was in Palestine?
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember which countries he represented, but a lot of times in like wartime, like when he was in Budapest, he represented multiple countries who didn't have, you know how sometimes countries don't have representatives because they're at war with each other. It's like they pull their diplomats out and they say, we're not talking to you. But they end up talking through a third party. Oh. And Switzerland, because they're recognized as being neutral, they're respected and trusted. And so Karl represented numerous countries, including the U.S., when he was in Switzerland.
Hungary. Yeah.
In Hungary, correct.
Yeah.
Budapest.
So where did the idea for this film come about in your life? I'm fascinated with this person who I had never heard of.
So it actually goes back to, do you remember Schindler's List? Mm-hmm. Steven Spielberg's movie. After that movie, he created a foundation. At the time, it was called Survivors of the Shoah Visual History. And the purpose was to record as many survivors' stories around the world as possible. Well, one of my closest friends lives in Omaha, and he started doing it. He became a videographer. And then I was working at a company called Real Productions in Monument, Colorado at the time. And we're like, hey, maybe I should be a videographer. So I got registered and I started doing interviews throughout Southern Colorado. And both my friend Mike and I, we were hearing stories about how diplomats were sometimes involved in rescuing Jews. And the first one I heard about was a Japanese diplomat named Sugihara. And it just fascinated me that there was this Japanese diplomat that was rescuing Jews. So we thought, well, that would be a great story. Let's do a story. Well, we realized that there was already a documentary about him. And then we found another one named Mendez, Portuguese. And there was a documentary producer in the middle of it. We're like, well, we want to do one that no one knows. And I don't remember how we actually found Karl Lutz, but once we heard his story, we were hooked.
Yeah.
And we got in touch with his stepdaughter, Agnes Hershey, and we got in touch with a man named Teo Chui, who is his biographer. And immediately we had a good relationship with them, and that's how it all started.
Sometimes in life, at historic moments, a situation arises which challenges the simple, decent man. And the simple, decent man can either do what is right and decent, but dangerous, or he can do nothing. Karl Lutz chose the previous. And because this simple, decent man did the right thing, many, many lives were saved.
What spurred Karl to act, to do this? Was it Palestine? Was it just a summation of his entire life? Was it an individual there in Hungary?
That's always the question, isn't it? You know, what's the motivation and why did they? Part of it, I believe, was his Christian upbringing and his desire to do something great, something worthwhile, something that takes a lot of character. I think Palestine was part of it. Well, as actually in the documentary, towards the close of the documentary, Agnes, the stepdaughter, said that, you know, he felt like God, this was something God had him do, something that he felt very strongly was his calling or his what he was put there to do, and he did it, you know. Because if you were to meet him, we interviewed some people and they were like, yeah, he was, you know, kind of a bureaucrat, you know, not the most exciting person, you know, kind of a,
yeah,
he just liked books and things like that. But he, you know, when he was put in the right situation and he had the right background, he almost had a superhuman strength to him where he was able to stand toe to toe against the Nazis and against the Hungarian, like the Arrow Cross, which was, they were the Nazi wannabes in Hungary.
Yeah. So.
I remember very well the 2 months that we spent in the bomb shelter with the Lutz family and with 28 other people, that I could even describe the two armchairs which were put together, which were my bed, green armchairs, and how it looked in that bomb shelter. And I remember the people, many of the people that were there. And I celebrated my 7th birthday in the bomb shelter. And Karl Lutz was very, very nice with me. He had spared some chocolate. And that was a highlight at that time, you can imagine.
Now, to put it into perspective, Schindler saved 1,200 Jews, approximately. Lutz is personally credited with how many?
Depends who you ask. For a while, the number was 62,000, and that was based on some research done. The latest numbers, we like to say tens of thousands because we really don't know. But I would say it's somewhere between 40 and 60,000.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And how exactly did he do that?
So again, it wasn't just him.
Yeah.
He worked with some amazing people. There was the Jewish underground, I think it's called the Chalitzim. It's like the pioneers. They were the ones who were doing a lot of the behind the scenes work. What Karl was doing is, as you know, head of, he was the vice consul in Switzerland in charge of this. It's kind of a complicated thing. It started with trying to get children, Jewish children, emigrating to or going to Palestine. And then they had a certain number of certificates. And then they basically transformed it into what they called Schutzbriefe, which is protective papers. And they were only allowed to have a certain number of Schutzbriefe, but then that wasn't enough. So they ended up recycling the numbers over and over again until they got caught, which was, you know, later on down the road. And there were other people that were making false protective papers, and they didn't stop them because if it was saving Jews, it was saving Jews. The other thing that Karl Lutz did was he interacted with some of the other diplomats in Budapest. Like the Swedish, you've heard of Wallenberg, Raoul Wallenberg. He's well known. Mm. He actually got his start. He came after Karl had already started this, and he did his own. So you had various diplomats also within Budapest. And so if you take all the diplomats in Budapest, I think they're credited for about 125,000 Jews being saved from the war.
Which is about half of the Jewish population of Budapest.
Right.
At the time.
At the time.
For 2 years, the vice consul helps over 10,000 Jewish children immigrate to Palestine. Most are orphans whose parents have been sent to concentration camps. Karl countersigns British-endorsed travel certificates and issues the young émigrés Swiss protective papers known as Schutzbrief.
He could have turned his back. The moment he signed those papers, but he didn't do so because these children, they grew on him and on Gertrude. So he watched them, was sure that they were safe. From then on, his name became known all over Hungary.
One of the really interesting things about the film that really struck me was his direct communications with Adolf Eichmann, the mastermind of the freaking Holocaust.
Yeah. The transportation expert that he brought in. Yeah, it was an interesting, when I said earlier, toe-to-toe. I mean, he went toe-to-toe with Eichmann and another guy named Weizenmeier. It was just amazing that he did that. But yeah, Eichmann was definitely a part of that because it was towards the end of the war and they wanted to complete the final solution, which thankfully they never got to do.
He said that Eichmann was a very unsympathetic person, of course, and it was very hard to deal with him. Mm. But he showed a lot of courage in dealing with Eichmann, although Lutz was rather shy and introverted, but with Weichmann, he became a different character and he really had the courage to keep up with Eichmann.
Was that ability to come out of his introverted shell and go toe-to-toe with him, was that something that you ever saw elsewhere in his life?
Sometimes that happened also in his private life, but very rarely. He was really rather silent. He didn't speak much, and he was very introverted. But when it was necessary in Budapest, he had to deal with the authorities. He had to deal also with Eichmann, with Wesenmeier. So he knew that that was his job, and then he became a different person.
On July 7th, Horthy stops the deportations. Karl Lutz sees a golden opportunity. He knows that Prime Minister Soce has also been unnerved by the worldwide criticism of Hungary. Lutz convinces Soce that to officially confirm the protection of the 8,000 Jewish children would send a clear message to the world that Hungary is not a barbaric outlaw nation. Unbeknownst to Soce, this will also assure the safety of the thousands who now hold Swiss protective letters. But Eichmann must approve. Once again, Lutz meets with the Nazi at the hotel turned fortress. Eichmann lashes out, revealing that he knows Lutz is issuing thousands of Schutzbrief to anyone who asks, and sheltering hundreds of Jews inside his office building. He then makes Lutz an offer. The 8,000 children can leave Hungary, but no more Schutzbrief will be recognized, and the rest of the Jews will be deported. Lutz refuses the deal.
What were the repercussions of his actions once the war was over? Because Switzerland at the time was a neutral country, and so using his powers to help all of these Jews out, I was surprised at that there were repercussions.
So there were a couple factors that came into play. He expected to go back and have people interested in what he did, right? I would have been. But what he found was, A, the war was over and they just wanted to kind of put it behind them and move on. And B, he got reprimanded for exceeding his authority. It's like, well, you're supposed to be neutral and you're supposed to stay neutral. That means don't get involved in internal affairs. And saving Jews, I guess, to some of them was getting involved in internal affairs, and he just couldn't do that. And so, yeah, there were repercussions. There was an investigation done, which was very disheartening to him. He ended up having to go and get some psychiatric help for a bit, mm-hmm. like a hospital type thing. And eventually the investigation, they didn't prosecute him. They just kind of said, oh, okay, you're all right. But he didn't progress much in the diplomatic corps. They put him as consul general in a little town called Bregenz. It's a cute little town, but it wasn't, you know, after Budapest, it's like, you know, just kind of a backwater town. And then he ended up retiring, but it was hard on him. Agnes has told us many times about how he was depressed a lot after that. And it was rough.
He was just very much disappointed that, first of all, nobody wanted to hear what happened in Budapest. And they had no idea how terrible the situation was. And his superiors didn't even take the time to listen to him. And they were very fussy with the costs because he lost a lot of furniture and other things in Budapest. The house burned completely down while we were in the bomb shelter. He was idealistic because he has never worked in Bern before. He didn't know the mentality of the employees in Bern. He started his career in the United States. He was there for 20 years. And then from Palestine, he came to Budapest. He didn't know the mentality that Swiss don't celebrate their heroes, or it takes very long until they celebrate them.
Yeah,
it's very hard here. And then there was the situation of the Cold War and the role of Switzerland during World War II, which nobody wanted. They wanted to keep silent about it. That's the reason why he was blamed to have overstepped his competences.
How did that affect him as a person?
Yeah, he was terribly frustrated. Because he got many honors he was honored by Yad Vashem, he was honored by the Germans, he got from Hungary, he really got many honors from other countries, But for him, it would have been important to be recognized, that his deeds would be recognized by Switzerland. And he was very, very frustrated. And he died very frustrated. Mm. He had depressions at the end.
Mm. One of the things that was really disheartening for me in watching the documentary was he wasn't really recognized until after his death in 1975.
Correct. And even after his death, it was slow going. I mean, you'd see a street named after him. They had a postage stamp with his name and his picture on it. And even like when we were there around 1999, 2000, I think again around 2001, 2002, there wasn't much. That was about it. That was all that we could see. Yad Vashem, the Jewish Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem, they recognized him as what they call the righteous among the nations. But in Switzerland, it wasn't until later, I mean, we're just talking the last 10 years or so, that the recognition has really started pouring in. And I'm glad for Agnes's sake, because she gets to see, you know, her stepdad get honored, and they had her at the, it's like their parliament, you know, at the government, they recognized him. They have a, I think they even have a room at the government building called the Karl Lutz room or something like that. Yeah. So there is a lot more recognition of what he did.
Perhaps the greatest, the most intoxicating power is to have, to almost have the power of life and death over other human beings. And in a very real way, Karl Lutz had the power in his hands to save human lives. And he did it.
To think of 60,000 people today with their children, their descendants, this must be 250,000 or 300,000 people in the world that owing their life. I mean, it's enormous.
When Carl's friend Jeffrey Tier learned of his death, he wrote a letter to Carl's brother Walter. Tier's words speak for all of those who would never forget the man who risked everything for them in one of humanity's darkest hours.
Your brother was part of the life of my wife and myself, that very life which he saved 30 years ago, together with so many others of all nations and creeds. Not even the Nobel Prize, which he would so richly have deserved, could have rewarded him for the gallantry and perfection with which he carried out more, far more, than his duty. My dear Mr. Lutz, if there is indeed a power that records the good deeds of us men and women, your brother's name is most surely at the top of that list. Never have I been so sad at the loss of a friend, for he was the best and bravest man I have ever known. May God give him in heaven the reward he did not receive on earth, and bless him forever.
Now, you started filming this back in 99, 2000?
Yes.
This has been, and this didn't release until January of 2020.
Correct.
What took you so long?
I remember when we started filming it, it was moving along really well. And I'm like, how is it that it takes some of these people 8 years to get a documentary done? You know, this is only 2 years and we're cruising right through it. Now here I am 20 years later, right? Well, it has to do with funding. And we ran out of money quickly. I mean, we got everything shot. Not everything. We got all the, you know, the European things filmed, and we got some of the interviews finished in the U.S. But then we ran out of money, and we tried shopping it. We went into a couple different partnerships to try to get distribution, which would give us finishing funds. And then, quite honestly, my partner Mike and I, we had to do everything we could to make ends meet, you know, on our different, for our families. And The idea of finishing the documentary just seemed like this huge weight that was kind of in the back of our minds. It's like, how are we going to get this done? So finally, after I started my own company and then decided to move from Colorado to Florida, I realized, well, I don't have any clients right now. I've got time. Now would be the perfect time to get the documentary done. And my wife and I talked about it. She's like, just do it. You know, don't worry about anything else. Just take the time. And it took me months of solid work that's a lot of editing and a lot of archival footage to find and music and voiceover. And then what do? We shot it back in the day when it was, you know, 4:3 aspect ratio on a Betacam, and now it's all high definition 16:9 widescreen. And we shot all of our reenactments in widescreen. We had some drone work that we did, and I was happy with how our reenactments, for not having any budget whatsoever.
Yeah.
We did it all for free. And then finally we finished it. And boy, what a relief it was to email Agnes and say, hey, remember us? We're done now.
What have you learned as a filmmaker in the process of this, as well as in some of your other work, like the documentary about Rachel Scott, one of the victims of the Columbine shooting?
What have I learned? I've learned that it's harder than you think when you go into it, and that it's also very fulfilling. I would like to do more documentaries. I just need to find a way of doing it and make an income at the same time. Once I get that figured out, I also learned that it's really important, because you're dealing with hours and hours of footage that and so much information, is be as structured and organized as you can from the very beginning, and work with the best people you know. And I love collaboration. Mm-hmm. It is so much fun to work with some of your best friends and people who have a passion to tell stories. So when Mike and I did the Carl Lutz project, the idea was to do a series of six similar projects, six righteous diplomats. And we called it Hidden Heroes of the Holocaust. And we pitched it to some PBS stations, and they all thought it was a great idea, but we had no money once again. And then once we realized that that was a hard sell, we decided to try doing a series called Hidden Heroes of History and broaden it. And again, we pitched it. We talked to a showrunner. Never seemed to get the funds, but you know, the dream hasn't died. You know, I still would love to do more Hidden Heroes of History, because I think we have so much to learn from these people that are just people like you and I, only they're put into a circumstance and they choose to rise to the challenge and not shrink from it. And especially in the times we're living right now, where there's so much polarization, I find that stories like Carl Lutz's story, he pulls everybody together, because we can all recognize what he did and what the people around him did. And everybody likes a story where somebody is, you know, trying to help other people and putting their lives at risk to help other people.
Encouraged by the Swiss diplomat's boldness, others begin to follow his lead. Among them is a 32-year-old Swede named Raoul Wallenberg, who launches his own daring rescue operation. Angelo Rota of the Vatican and Friedrich Born of the International Committee of the Red Cross also extend diplomatic immunity to several buildings, and another 8,000 Jews find refuge.
Who are some of those other heroes through history and heroes of the Holocaust that you're thinking about?
We had different categories. We even had hidden heroes of medicine, like subcategories, hidden heroes of the U.S. space program. So I worked at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station for 4 years, and I met a lot of incredible people who were the behind the scenes people of, you know, getting the Apollo launched. Mm-hmm. And we actually shot a little pilot, and we got three old timers together, and we're walking through the old Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, talking about what it was like, you know, when you push the go button, you're not sure if it's going to go up or if it's going to go out, you know, it's like, yeah, blow up. And so as far as on my list, there were people from the space program that, you know, they're not common names, but they're, you know, people like Dr. Al Bruckner and guys that were just amazing. And then in the hidden heroes of medicine, people like, well, Ben Carson now is not an unknown name, but he was a surgeon, and his story of growing up, to me, he's a hidden hero. And hidden heroes of even different wars, you know, like you mentioned, or like the Civil War. Civil War is a war that people don't really know a lot about, but I'm going through the Ken Burns documentary myself, and it's an amazing story.
It's so good.
So,
it's so good.
You know, there's heroes everywhere. It's just a matter of, oh, another one we were doing, hidden heroes of the civil rights movement. Mm. So right near where I live is the story of a man and a woman, a black couple that were amazing couple. Back in the 50s, They helped start the NAACP, and they just did a lot of amazing things. Well, they were killed by a bomb that went off in their house. Well, he was killed, and then later she passed away, you know, because those were the stakes back then in the civil rights movement. So lots of opportunity to tell stories.
What advice would you have for a young filmmaker who's listening to this, has a passion for telling historical stories or telling even recent stories? What advice would you give to them for, you know, how to get funded and how to collaborate properly and who to collaborate with and that sort of stuff?
I would say start where you are. An example is there's a museum near my house called the Warbird Museum. And it's these old World War II, World War I planes. And I'm trying to come up with a way to just fund doing stories about some of the pilots that still are alive that flew in those planes. So that's, you know, in my neighborhood. So I would say look in your neighborhood, whether it's an older person who maybe served in Vietnam or somebody who did something amazing. Start local, because then your expenses are a lot lower. And even if you have to do it totally for free to get going, I think it's a great exercise to learn how to tell stories, learn how to interview people, learn what kind of B-roll and what kind of archival material will be helpful, where to find music, you know, the whole process of building a documentary. Start with a short one, you know, don't start with a 2-hour documentary, do like a 10-minute vignette or something. And, if you do a couple of those and people notice, maybe you can hook up with a local college, community college, or, you know, depending on where you are, film schools, places where you can interact with other people and, you know, kind of start that way. As far as funding, you said funding. Well, if I had an answer to that one, I would be on my next documentary right now.
But how did you fund the first part of the documentary before you stopped filming?
We interacted with three different Swiss foundations who gave us some money to get over there and to be able to rent equipment. And we were able to also get some free hotel nights over in Europe. And we were able to get a couple free flights on, I think it was Swiss Air at the time. And that was it. You know, so that money didn't last very long. So the rest of it was self-funded. My friend Mike and I, we did it on our own dime.
Any final thoughts about this project, about this film, and what's the main takeaway you want people to come away with?
I think the important thing is that if you are in such a situation, you see people suffering, people being deported, people being treated like animals, that you have to do something. Many, many people didn't even care, and it was dangerous to help these people. And he really had the feeling that he had to help, and it was his motivation was his religion. And he couldn't just look at the people being deported. He just had to act. It was not his job. He was not sent to Budapest to rescue Jews. But he felt it, this was the job what God gave him. Mm. And then he thought, God, he knew it as a tremendous task, and it's against the government. It's not as what the government in Bern would like. And he was a very conscious employee. And yet he thought in this place, the laws of life are stronger than man-made regulations. That's what he said.
I think the takeaway I want people to come away with is don't put Carl on a pedestal, but look at him as like you or me, but he chose to rise to the occasion. Because what that does for me is it helps me see that it doesn't exempt me from, like, if I'm ever put in that situation, I can't say, well, I'm not like Carl Lutz. It's like, well, actually, I kind of am like Carl Lutz, you know, and I get the choice like he did. You know, am I going to just be a bureaucrat and hide behind my computer or behind my pants? You know, they didn't have computers then. Hide behind my ledger and just, you know, okay, this is what I was told to do. I can't get involved. I can't, you know, speak for the people who have no voice, but I can actually make a difference. And he did, you know, he was an unlikely hero. And a lot of the heroes in this world are unlikely heroes.
Brian Berugi, thanks for being on the Exploration Films podcast.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Exploration Films podcast. To check out this film, you can go to our new streaming service, exploreflix.world. Exploration Films has been a pioneer and leader in the faith and family film space, and that's why we're so excited to tell you we finally have launched our own streaming service, exploreflix.world. If you or your family are looking for amazing films, compelling documentaries, unique stories, concerts, and Christian growth resources that all support your Christian worldview, then check out exploreflix.world and get 7 days free. All the films we talk about on this podcast and many, many more are available there. You can find a link at our website, explorationfilms.com, or you can go directly to exploreflix.world. For the entire Exploration Films team, I'm Steve Ryder. Thank you for investing your time with us.
That's a wrap.